speculate.
According to yesterday.
What? Eric, you ready? So we have an audience this morning of thousands. Thank you. We're going to do a public hearing on Senate Bill 5532. This is March 24th, 2015. It's 8:35 or something in the morning. The Psychiatric Security Review Board is up today. We're looking forward to hearing their testimony. I would just offer for the few of us that are here this morning that the State Hospital and especially the Psychiatric Security Review Board have had a 180-degree change. A lot of that is the result of the good work done by Juliet, now Britton, right?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And as a result, we're seeing changes being made that I think are really a long time coming, 10-year process, but we are happy to see it happening. So if you could step up with us, we'd appreciate it. And Kate's not here this morning, so I don't know what that means, but it means
Michelle's
something. but we have Michelle Lisper instead, and she's here too. Linda, you want to say a few words?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, this program, as the chair indicated, works closely with both the state hospital and with the AMH community program, so you'll see a lot of overlap with what you've heard the last few days. In terms of process, the usual two-page LFO summary is out on OLIS. We'll have as well as the agency presentation. There will be a brief summary of the governor's budget. This is a pretty simple budget, so it won't take long. And then we'll leave a little time for public testimony if there is any, although this has not historically been a real popular budget.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
May I just welcome my constituent, Jordan Lay, who's sitting right back there?
Yes.
Jordan's a junior at Westview who's decided to spend 2 days of his spring break job shadowing me, which suggests that either he is a very forethoughtful man or he's really bored out of his gourd and doesn't have anything better to do. So,
probably the former.
I'm hoping for the former. I'm thinking the former.
I'm going with the latter. Welcome to the Capitol. I hope you have a great time. You've got a wonderful senator to follow around. Have all your batteries plugged in. She moves fast, talks fast, and you'll be busy the next 2 days. Please enjoy yourself. Welcome. Just so you know, I have to leave at 9 o'clock to go to a meeting, which I hope I'll be back by 9:30. Shouldn't take too long, but I'll unexpectedly. So you'll be able to take it?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm going to eat fast.
Please get started.
Thank you, Senator Bates, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. Thank you for that introduction. I'm excited to share what our board has been doing the last 2 years since we were last before this committee. I'm Juliet Britton. I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I came on board as the Executive Director just when we were finishing up the last session. So there's four major areas that our board is responsible for, and I know over the last 2 to 3 days you've heard many of the legal classifications and how this state manages those individuals. For our responsibilities, our primary and certainly the most significant work that we do is in the area of the those that assert the insanity defense to a criminal charge. In our state, we refer to that as GEI, guilty except for insanity. That is the adult standard. And for youth and juveniles, that's responsible except for insanity. So once an individual in court asserts the insanity and successfully asserts it, they're placed under our jurisdiction for supervision and monitoring. Unlike other states, once that jurisdiction transfers to us, the board makes all decisions regarding the placement of that individual. Secondly, and this is a more recent responsibility, as you might recall at last session, the legislature created a new type of civil commitment, Senate Bill 421. It's sometimes called the extremely dangerous civil commitment, but we call it Senate Bill 421 for the most part. And we are also responsible for supervising and monitoring those civil commitments that are placed under our jurisdiction by various courts. Back in 2009, this legislature assigned the responsibility of gun relief to our board as well for those who successfully or who wish to petition to have their gun rights restored after they've previously received a court mental health adjudication. So this is broader than just those that have asserted GEI. It's primarily targeted to the civil commitments who later want to come before us after a period of stability and want to request that their firearms are restored. And finally, in 2013, this state has begun to implement a new sex offender designation program where we're going to give all sex offenders in the state who have to register a 321 designation. And so our board is responsible for doing that for our clients who also have to register as a sex offender. So that's the big overview.
What's a 321 designation?
321 designation. So three, if an individual receives a three, that means that they're at the highest risk, and one is the lowest risk. So we're in the process of working with Board of Parole, Department of Corrections, to designate all of our sex offenders. This is a multi-year process to set this new program up.
So, Mr. Chair, I follow up with that. Is that the follow-up of what we did a couple years ago then with House Bill 2549 that gave the three different steps, the 3-2-1?
Co-Chair Bates, yes, Representative Olson, correct, exactly. And we're just responsible for the designation of our clients.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Catchy.
Yes. Our adult and juvenile panel, we have 10 members total. We have two panels, a juvenile and an adult panel. Each panel has the various disciplines, psychiatrist, psychologist, attorney, probation officer, and public member. All of our board members have full-time employment, and they do this as an additional duty. We have hearings weekly, and our board members receive $334 per day for their work. And I say that only to highlight the tremendous public service that our board members do. So they're holding their full-time employment outside of the board operations and sit on our hearings weekly, receiving the minimal stipend.
Mr. Chair. We recently confirmed a new member of the PSRB because you guys were having trouble making quorum. You may not have a sense, having been there a relatively short time, but do you have a sense of whether you have trouble filling spots on PSRB because of the workload and relatively low remuneration or reimbursement, or is it because it's just tough to find the right people?
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, it is tough to find the various disciplines to give up one day a week to sit on hearings. Now, not every board member sits every week. The average is 2 to 3 times per month. But it's difficult, especially in, I would say for all of the various disciplines. It's difficult, and we've had to do a tremendous amount of outreach to our various partnering agencies to identify. And sometimes some of the feedback I get from potential applicants is that, you know, I can't afford that. You know, giving up a day of employment just for $334.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Do you have a sense about how other states manage this? Do you have any sense about how your counterparts in other states manage this in terms of compensating their members, how their boards are constructed and how their members are compensated? Are there ones that are analogous to ours and compensate differently?
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Steiner Hayward, we are the only state other than Connecticut that has this model to supervise those that assert the insanity defense. Most states, the vast majority of states, use the courts.
Okay.
So they're presumably, the cost of that is the judge's salary. They also don't have the board that continues necessarily to supervise while they're out on conditional release, which makes our state very unique and considered innovative.
Okay. We'll have another conversation about this offline. Thank you, Ms. Britton.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Just to follow back up on that line of question, we had to Senator Steiner's question about the comparison with other states and the fact that Oregon is with Connecticut unique. We had quite a discussion when we were doing Senate Bill 420 as to whether or not we would continue in this particular structure or not, and it was decided that we would continue this kind of structure. But I want to go back, and is there any, which particular discipline are you having the biggest problem with?
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, primarily the psychiatrist would be the discipline that is the most difficult to fill. I would say second to that would be the psychologist and attorney position. We have more choice as to who can be the public member, obviously, right? There's far less psychiatrists than there are any other of the other disciplines.
So, following back up and going back with the joint work that you're doing with the OHA, with the hospital now, excuse me, the state hospital, has that caused any additional problems and workload?
Senator Bates, Co-Chair Bates, Senator Winters, no problems. If anything, it's helped facilitate the appropriate placement of all of the GEI clients, whether they fall under the State Hospital Review Panel or the PSRB.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to ask a question here, too. The two psychiatrists, do you recruit them from the hospital or outside the hospital?
Senator Bates, typically there are certain limitations statutorily that our board member cannot be full-time employed by a community mental health agency. So for the most part, historically, our psychiatrist member has been in private practice. We also want to be sensitive to conflicts cases. So if it's a psychiatrist who treated our clients, there potentially are some conflicts to then have them sit on the hearings and make decisions about their own work, if you will. So that being said, there certainly are former psychiatrists of the Oregon State Hospital or former psychiatrists that maybe have moved on to a different employment that could be eligible, and we are actively
Let's talk about that discussing. Conflict for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that work in two ways. They know the client. This is very touchy stuff you're doing, releasing people to the public with public safety issues involved, yet we want them out of the hospital. We want them out there. I'm not so certain that most physicians couldn't deal with that conflict and actually bring more to that panel, and that would be part of their job. You'd automatically have two people there every week who quite likely would know these people, have a good insight into them, even though there'd be a conflict. They should be able to declare that conflict and deal with it, I would think.
Co-Chair Bates, our hearings have to fall within the rules around administrative hearings, and part of that, or one of the big concepts of that, is that the decision maker is neutral and you only consider the evidence at the hearing. I will say that we currently have five board members, so we currently are not at a deficit, if you will. And typically, if we have to go without the five board members, we plan ahead for potential vacancies and actively recruit ahead of time. So I wouldn't necessarily identify it as a crisis. But certainly we have been without one board member at any given time. But we have continued, as you'll see with our performance measures, to have our hearings on time and get people out of the hospital despite that.
Who are your five board members by class right now?
We have Senator Bates. We have Chair Jenna Morrison is our probation officer. Bennett Garner is our MD. Kate Lieber is our...
He's a psychiatrist?
Attorney. Yes,
okay.
Senator
I don't care
Bates.
The names. I want to know by class.
Oh, by class.
Psychologist, you have
attorney,
one of each?
Parole.
We have one of each. Each panel has one of each. Yes, Senator Bates.
And that's it.
So you have two full... I'm sorry, Senator.
Oh, go ahead.
You have two full panels now.
Co-Chair Bates, Senator Steiner Howard, yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Not sure I'm convinced. Okay? It's not sure I'm convinced. Well, I'm going to take more time with the panel up, but we'll talk about it. You're dealing with a really explosive potential situations here, mm-hmm. but you're doing a great job. I don't want to get in your way, okay? But I'm a little concerned.
Thank you, Senator.
And follow-up question, the last one for me at least. So where would that board stipend have to move to, do you think, to entice people and properly reimburse them for something they're trying to do here, primarily as obviously a public service?
Senator Bates, that would be a question for our board members, I would say. I certainly can talk to our board members about that and provide you with that feedback. In the short term, I have ensured that for the preparation day that our board members are typically, you know, our board members have to prepare for hearings. So they're actually giving up not only the day for the hearing, but a preparatory day. So they are getting paid for both of those days currently. I can talk to the board and provide you with that feedback. I think directly hearing from the board members would be most appropriate for that question.
And how many cases do they see on an average day?
Senator Bates, approximately 16 to 20. Some of those are administrative. So about 8 to 10 are administrative, but we typically have 8 to 10 full hearings a day. It is a full day's work.
That's a lot.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Thank you.
Senator
Winters.
Another, and I think for this panel, not just looking at the PSRB issue, but also overall the need for, in Oregon, psychiatrists and psychologists. It's not, I mean, I need to put that on the record just in case someone who is listening think that this is unique to,
no,
but
no.
It is not. It is
underpaid.
And it's a statewide issue of getting individuals.
National.
Yes. So just needed to make that statement. And
our board meets its objectives primarily in four ways. As we just previously discussed, we conduct over 700 hearings per year. That is how our board makes its decisions and moves our clients through the recovery process. We oversee the community conditional release of our individuals and ensure that they are receiving the services that they need, which emphasizes the public safety. We're working collaboratively with AMH and also Department of Human Services. I'm going to get to our data here in a second, but we don't only serve or supervise those with a serious mental illness. We also have those that are developmentally or intellectually disabled. So DHS is one of our major partners as well. And finally, we conduct outreach with all of our stakeholders to lessen some of the barriers that our particular clients face in order to attempt to integrate fully our clients into the community setting. So here's some demographics. This is our adult PSRB snapshot. This was as of January of this year. As you can see, most of our clients reside outside of the hospital. 380 of them are on conditional release. We have 145 at OSH. This does not include Sharp's clients, so they have approximately, it's in the 80 to 90 range, I believe. We have 4% veterans, and most of our individuals suffer from a psychiatric, serious and persistent mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar being the top two. The vast majority of our clients are dual diagnosed with substance abuse issues. It's very critical that our clients are treated both for their psychiatric and substance abuse. Here's a quick look at our juvenile demographic. Far few clients. This is a relatively new defense. REI, responsible except for insanity, was created statutorily in 2005, I believe. Most of our youth, just like our adult population, reside outside of a secure setting. Most are male. What's interesting about our juvenile population is 40% are DD eligible. And I don't know if you remember the previous slide, single-digit percentage. So most of our adult clients are not DD eligible. Most of our youth are. So particularly with our youth population, we're working with Department of Human Services to provide and ensure the services in the community are assisting our clients. So this is a chart that you probably saw, or at least saw the data over the last couple days. So the trend is, the blue line is the number of GEI, and this is total GEI, so this includes SHARP. The blue line is the GEI patients that are at the state hospital, and the red line is the number of GEI clients that are residing outside in the community. So the trend, absolutely, since 2008 or so, has been more clients are leaving the state hospital and residing in the community, and we're able to keep our clients in the community. Another trend we're seeing is the number of defendants asserting the insanity defense is actually going down. So this is what this graph shows. Particularly starting in the 2010 range, the number of new GEI clients in our system is going down. There's lots of speculation as to why that is. Early interventions, perhaps. Individuals are not entering the criminal justice system to begin with. You probably heard about Marion County's pilot project where they're working with police to intervene early, so those with serious mental illness don't even have to enter the jail and criminal justice system. All right, this is our map. I always find this helpful, and I'm going to show this identical map. This is where our clients are coming from. So these are the numbers. These are the raw numbers of GEI clients by county. And in a second, I'm going to show you where we're actually placing our clients. As you can imagine, the I-5 corridor, for the most part, has the highest number of those coming under our board's jurisdiction, just given the population of those various cities. We have some outliers. Lane County in particular, Klamath County, has a higher number than you would think, given their population. So this is where our clients are coming from, and this is where our clients are residing. Some of our counties are providing services to more than they're actually putting in, but what's unique about the PSRB community placement, and I think it's a positive thing compared to maybe the civil system, is that a client under our jurisdiction doesn't necessarily have to go back to the county where they came from. That might not necessarily be in their best interest. They might not want to go. You know, they're at the state hospital, they're in their recovery treatment, and recognize that maybe they want to get a fresh start somewhere else. They might not want to run into victims, perhaps, of the instant offense. And Addictions and Mental Health and DHS have really worked with us to place clients where they're invested in living, which is a good thing. So I only say that often, or I only show this map because I often get questions, well, where are our clients coming from and where are they living? But there really is statewide resources for our clients, which I think gives increases the chance that a client's going to be successful if they can go where they want to go. Day in the life of a PSRB client on conditional release. Our clients are usually, this is very typical, so there's definitely less or more depending on the individual client, but the average client is going to start off when they leave the hospital of doing at least 20 hours of structured activity, and most of our clients exceed the minimum requirement that the board orders. typically a client's going to live in licensed residential housing at first. So that's the secure residential treatment facility, residential treatment facility, depending on their risk. And it's very rare that you're going to come out of the hospital and go straight into supported housing. But eventually, most of our clients, almost 40% of our clients currently do not live in licensed residential. So eventually, our clients move through the continuum of care. Typically, our clients are going to start off with medication management. And these are some of the ways that we mitigate the risk of our clients. And we'll end this presentation with our recidivism rate. Individual therapy is provided in any special treatment that might be warranted, sex offender treatment, DBT, which is a specialty individual therapy. As I said previously, many, if not most, of our clients have substance issues, so substance treatment is a critical part of their recovery. Random UAs, skills training, group therapy, and supported employment are also some of the interventions that the board ensures our clients receive. So how well are we keeping our clients into the community safely? We maintain every month 99% of our clients in the community. So that's due in part to this body authorizing funding for community resources. If we don't have the resources to maintain a client, whether they're doing very well or when they're not doing well, if we don't have those resources, we can't keep them on conditional release. So I think this is an indicator of some of the strides we've made the last couple bienniums to make sure that there is enough resources in the community. This is our recidivism rate. The goal is, the lower is better. The goal is to not necessarily go up high. So we recently recalculated how we calculate recidivism, and it's based on those out on conditional release, what is the rate at which they reoffend. And if you don't know already, corrections is in the double digits, almost 30%, I believe, and our recidivism rate is 0.22%.
So, I'm sorry, so just step me back just a little bit. You recalculated, tell me what you were doing before and what you're doing now.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, we previously were only counting someone recidivating if we revoked them from conditional release.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And so we wanted to really look at the total population on conditional release. How many of them are actually being convicted of a new felony or misdemeanor, because we didn't necessarily revoke everyone who committed a new offense. And just to give you numbers, last year, for example, we had one individual who was convicted out of the 380.
Did you go back and recalculate 2012 and 2013 based on those rates, or you just recalculated for, you just used a new calculation for 2014?
Senator Steiner Hayward, we recalculated for the 3 years that are up here. We went back. We didn't have the specific data prior to that. So we've always met our recidivism goal. So that's never been a challenge for the board. We just recalculated how we calculate it.
And just I understand exactly what you're saying. I'm just trying to understand. I'm impressed by the relatively precipitous drop between 2013 and 2014. Now, obviously, you're talking about small numbers, but is there anything you can particularly attribute to, or it's just that you're always doing generally well, and last year was a particularly good year?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, it's low numbers and it's relatively consistent. We have one or two individuals commit new offenses. Okay. Most of those are the vast majority are not person on person. Last year it was an escape because he ran away out of state. So which is a felony, Class C felony. So for the most part, it's not as a vast drop that it might look on the chart. It's low numbers. So,
Senator Winters. Just to comment, this PSRB historically
has been one of the agencies that you could actually count on to know that the work that they do, it's a rarity that you have seen over the years that I've been on this panel, of their recidivism numbers to actually go up. It's probably one of the most vigilant and thorough boards. Thank you, and you're doing a very good job. And I think when we added Senate Bill 420 to help that process, I think it's just even getting better, and hopefully it will continue. So,
thank you. One of our other performance measures is the timeliness of our hearings. As I said, that is how our board facilitates our clients moving through the system. And thanks to this body, two bienniums ago, at the very end of our hearing, this committee authorized two to three FTE to help our board meet this particular performance measure. And as you can, so that was 2011, I believe. And as you can see, since then, for the most part, we've met our performance measure and timeliness.
I think you're exceeding it, aren't you?
I'm sorry?
I think you're exceeding your...
We are exceeding. Yes, Senator Winters. And that really is, I mean, it takes staff to create the packets that allow our board to do their work. And absolutely, that is the most critical piece to our board operation, without a doubt. And we're finally now at an appropriate service level. So some of the major initiatives since the last time we were before you, obviously continuing our safety record, as Senator Winters just discussed, managing the increased numbers of individuals on conditional release. From a board perspective, a staff perspective, having more numbers on conditional release is more work than having somebody at the state hospital. There's more monitoring, there's more supervision, there's more opportunities for clients to move through the continuum, and also sometimes when things aren't going well, move backwards in their recovery. And all of that requires our board to conduct hearings and the staff to process all of those actions. As we previously discussed, as Representative Olson asked, we're also implementing that sex offender designation program. We're having to pull archived records because this program entails designating all of the sex offenders who have ever been under our jurisdiction since the late 70s. So there's a lot of work that's going into that. And then also, as I think Senator Winters was talking
I'm sorry, Ms. Britton, I have a really quick question about that.
Yes.
I'm really interested in this because I'm on the Pay for Prevention Steering Committee, which is kind of looking at how do we predict who's going to end up in foster care and then use evidence-based programs to prevent that, which in its own way is analogous to what you're trying to do. So I don't think it's may not be worth diving into in great detail here, but I'd really be interested, if it's not too hard, if you'd submit something back to the committee. It talks a little bit about how you're looking at factors that play into your ranking system. And I mean, if you're looking back to the 70s, you know whether somebody reoffended or not, at least was convicted of reoffending. You don't necessarily know for sure if they reoffended. So I'd be really interested from a predictive modeling perspective to understand more about that, if that's easy. If it's not, maybe we can have a conversation about it at some point.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, the actual bill mandates that a risk assessment tool be designated by Department of Corrections, and they've actually designated the Static 99 risk assessment tool.
So you have one already.
One already.
Then never mind. I'll look at that one.
There are some challenges because it's not predicted for youth and females.
Right.
So, but for the most part, that tool has been identified.
Then a quick follow-up. In your experience, as you're looking back, or maybe you don't know enough to know yet, has it been accurate? If you look at the people, if you designate people, you know, if you look at somebody from 1981,
give them a designation and then look forward to see whether they reoffended or not. Have you found it to be reasonably accurate in our population?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, unfortunately, it's too early to tell. We haven't quite gotten there in implementing the program. But hopefully by the next biennium, we'll have those answers.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Sure. So as we talked about our three major performance measures earlier with our three charts, we've continued to fulfill our mandate of public safety with our cumulative recidivism rate of 0.64%. Also continuing to keep our clients, 99% of our clients, in the community while on conditional release. And that's what's interesting is we've had an increase. You would think the number would go down. You have the potential to have more revocations as our numbers on conditional release go up, and we've actually been able to maintain our the same percentage of clients on conditional release. It's critical, I think, that we have the continuum of care resources in the community, because when somebody gets subacute, we don't necessarily have to revoke anymore. We have our secure facilities we could use. There are various subacute respite beds available in the community, and we look to use those resources first before revocation. The GEI census, as we previously talked about, has decreased 30% in the last 4 years, and that allows us to ensure that when our clients are ready to leave the state hospital, we can have beds for them ready to go right, and they're not staying in the hospital longer than they have to. And then finally, this last biennium, that new civil commitment, Senate Bill 421 responsibility that we undertook, we created our rules for that and took our first two clients under that Senate bill, and have created that program and have that program now up and running to receive any more clients that might be sent our way. Some of the challenges, and I'm sure this is going to be duplicative of what you've heard the last few days from the state hospital and AMH, but there's always a demand for beds for our clients, whether they're in the hospital or they're in the community and they need to be stepped up, for example, to a higher level of care. Particularly for our clients, in general, those who have a psychiatric condition, there's misconceptions about that, there's fear around that. But for our clients, they also have a criminal history, which makes it even more difficult to place clients in certain jobs, for example, or find them adequate housing that will keep them safe and stable. So there's renting housing barriers, employment barriers that we're constantly working on. Particularly, I think we need to give credit to our community mental health agencies who have housing specialists, who have employment specialists. This is all they do. They are building relationships with the private sector to allow our clients to integrate into the community. And it's with that hard work that we're able to have, as I said previously, about 40% of our clients living in a non-residential setting.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. Is there one community that's doing better than the other? And I'm thinking about housing and employment barriers, because I know in public safety, I think that all the counties in the state would like to have the resources and the availability as Clackamas County when it comes to housing and what they have done in that particular county. So is there one that stands out that you, when you talk about the county's resources and those availabilities, and one where you would think that we need to do more work in order to bring some resources.
Representative Nathanson, Senator Winters, Multnomah County has, for the most part, the most choice, if you will, at various levels of support and services. So they have anywhere or anything from a licensed residential all the way down to independent living or what we call intensive case management. It's analogous to the ACT model, where you can live in your own home and the services come to you. You're not living alone, if you will. And certainly they have implemented the most opportunities for our clients to live at the various levels of care. And I don't know if it's because Multnomah County has the most employment opportunities, but that's also a county where they seem to be able to get our clients into employment, mainstream employment opportunities, more so than some of the other counties, just given the opportunities for employment there.
I think one would say that they probably have the most financial resources.
Yes, absolutely. So some of the opportunities for the board, utilizing the lower GEI caseload to make sure that we can continue to have our hearings on time and adequately supervise our clients. We're certainly working with counties maybe who haven't served our clients previously, who are interested in that, and we're doing a lot of outreach, both AMH and myself. I mean, we literally visit the state every month. I'm visiting. I've been to almost every county the last 2 years, where we're doing outreach. You know, even within the mental health system, there sometimes is some fear about supervising our clients. And so we're even doing outreach to our colleagues, if you will. It's not necessarily the public who has this fear and stigmatization against PSRB clients. And finally, providing the feedback to AMH, who ultimately is responsible for the services that are provided, and the counties, to ensure that they are recognizing where the needs of our clients and then implementing programs that can make our clients successful. So we don't have too much legislation related to our board operations this session, but there are a couple. Our gun relief program has a sunset, and so we have a housekeeping bill that would remove the sunset and permanently assign those duties to our board. We do not anticipate any fiscal. The number of requests are very minimal, and our current hearings staff can absorb those responsibilities. It is actually a joint bill with Oregon State Police. They receive federal funding related to their records reconciliation, and having a certified ATF relief program is a requirement. So that is something that is good for the state to continue that federal funding. Some of our mental health advocacy groups, and specifically Representative Greenlick is working with them. There are three bills that would affect PSRB clients. One is to modify the PSRB mission statutorily that would include public safety, which is our current mission, and also recovery and reintegration. Secondly, it would create an expungement for GEI, certain GEI offenses. So as you know, currently felons can request expungement after a certain period of time. Supervision ends, and this would create a GEI expungement, the potential for expungement. And then finally, House Bill 2556 is being proposed that would actually shorten the length of jurisdiction that individuals are placed under the PSRB. So those are the three major legislations affecting operations. Currently in practice, 99% of the GEIs in the state are stipulated, and individuals in practice, are put under our jurisdiction for the most part for the maximum sentence they would have received had they pled guilty. Even though the statute currently allows up to the maximum, we're still seeing individuals being placed under our jurisdiction for the maximum length by courts. Our governor's recommended budget is current service level. We feel that we are currently staffed appropriately to adequately support our board. We do not, this does not necessarily take into account if we were to have an unexpected increase in caseload. But for the most part, we feel that things are going very well. And with that, are there any questions for me?
Senator Winters.
I don't have a question. I just have a comment. And you've done an outstanding job.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
You know, I've followed the action of PSRB since, I think, 2001. Mm-hmm. And looking at not only the numbers, but the clarity in which you have made your presentation. And I wrote on my little comment, excellent presentation.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
You know, and I know you came in, you know, doing some rough spots, and we have a habit on this legislative side of kind of dumping a lot more on, and I think you met all those challenges, and so I just personally want to say, you know, thank you and what a good job you're doing.
Thank you very much, and I'll relay that to our board and staff and all of our community partners. It definitely, the takeaway is, you know, we don't do this alone. It's the collaboration between all of our agencies, and I think that all of the agencies really have committed to working together, and I think our data supports that we've been successful at that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, who's taking over here?
I have.
Yeah, I have.
So maybe Representative.
Julia, I just got to say, too, I mean, you know, as long as you've been here, I have to admit and echo what Senator Winter's comments were. I mean, we were deeply involved in a lot of stuff. With PSRB, and I really feel really confident with what you've been doing, your leadership, and I understand that it takes, you know, a whole ship to make it work, but appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Olson.
Great. Any other questions for Ms. Britton right now? All right, Ms. Lisper.
Good morning, I guess, Co-Chair Nathanson and committee. I'm Michelle Lesper. I'm with the Department of Administration, and I'm the chief, part of the chief financial's office. I'm the analyst assigned to PSRB. In the governor's budget, as was mentioned, there really isn't that much to add. The governor's budget does support the current service level. There are some emerging issues that Juliet has mentioned. The biggest impact overall is the demand of the community mental health system as it increases overall. And basically, how they deal with the community and housing and support. As far as the 10-year plan goes, PSRB, you know, has proven by working with their partners in placement and with their other agencies and stakeholders, and are maintaining their direction towards public safety as involved with the 10-year plan and community mental health. I really, there isn't too much to add. I think most folks know that their budget is predominantly general fund. Their FTEs really have not changed over the past few bienniums with the staffing that they're working with. And that's pretty much all I have. There are no initiatives for this.
Ms. Lisper, are you able to give us a number? We were talking earlier, as you heard, about the relatively pitiful, if I may say so, remuneration for PSRB members. Are you able to break out their budget? Maybe it's in the actual budget. Is it in the? I'll look for it in the budget then and play with the numbers. Never mind. I haven't looked at the actual details. I just think we need to think a little bit more about the remuneration piece and try to figure out how to make. I mean, you've got good people, and that's great. But if you have to struggle every single time you have to find one, and these people are providing a really important service to the state, I think we need to think about it.
A quick question along that line. The individuals who are appointed to PSRB are vetted and actually through the governor's office. Is that not correct?
Co-chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, that is correct.
And then confirmed by the Senate.
Correct.
So part of your actual struggle, in addition to that, is the timeline, and sometimes that can pose some issues for having a full membership.
Correct.
Just needed to put things in context. Thank you.
Great. Questions for Ms. Lisper? And my understanding is that nobody's signed up for public comment. Is there anybody who wanted to offer public testimony and didn't sign up? Okay. Any other business before the committee? Ms. Ames, anything else?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, just remind you that tomorrow we will only do public testimony for AMH Mental Health, and that is normally a very popular public testimony day, and President Courtney intends to start us out tomorrow.
Okay. Never a dull moment. All right, anything else, committee? If not, we're adjourned. Go enjoy an extra 33 minutes. That you didn't know you were going to have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.